From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Philippe Jailly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. President Trump wants to recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. A visit from the leader of Brazil, the so-called Trump of the tropics, the latest on U.S.-China trade talks, Britain, Brexit, and the EU, and New Zealand takes action in the wake of those terror attacks on two mosques. Let's start with this story about President Trump, Israel, and the Golan Heights. On his favorite platform, Twitter, the president said that the United States should recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. For people who might not know, this is a territory that the Israelis took from Syria in 1967 during the so-called Six-Day War. So they've controlled it for a long time, Dan. But nevertheless, what the president said was something new.
No question about it. And it was a political gift to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu's in a tough re-election battle. The election in Israel is on the 9th of April. And it's pretty obvious that Trump wanted to help Netanyahu. And that's the way Netanyahu received the news in Jerusalem, with big thanks to Trump for delivering a holiday miracle. It was a Jewish holiday called Purim on that day. And it was during a visit to Israel by the American Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. But it wasn't up to Pompeo. It was all up to the president. He announced it on Twitter. He said it's time to recognize it as the sovereign territory of Israel. And around the world, people said, except for doing Netanyahu a favor, why? What's the difference? It probably won't make much of a difference on the ground. Keep in mind, though, Syria would like to have the Golan back. Syria has been torn apart by its civil war now for 8 years. It didn't seem to be an immediate issue. By the way, Israeli officials explained to them it's really important because it sends a message the U.S. stands with Israel. And so Iran, which has fighters in Syria, should not dare to come near the Golan Heights. At least America considers that part of Israel.
And, you know, Philippe, there was always this notion that as part of some kind of a two-state solution, which has been talked about as time immemorial, that the West Bank and the Golan Heights and Gaza, all of that would be resolved somehow. But to Dan's point, given the mess in Syria, if that were not in Israeli hands, you conceivably could have Hezbollah there and all of that.
Right.
So in a way, from a strategic standpoint, this is Israeli territory, and there's no way they're going to give it back anyway, regardless of what the president says.
Right. You can argue with the mess in Syria. It would be a very dire situation for Israel and the north of Israel if, at this point, you had Iranian or Hezbollah or even Syrian forces on the Golan Heights. Because, I mean, it's a strategic position from which you can shell almost all the rest of Israel. But the implication from the international law point of view is very big. I mean, if you condone the annexation of the Golan Heights, which Israel did in 1981, what is the difference with the annexation of Crimea by Putin? What is the implication for the rest of the territory that was seized by Israel in 1967, i.e. the West Bank, no longer Gaza, but the West Bank? So it's very worrying for the Palestinians and for the prospect of a two-state solution with the Palestinians.
Dan, also, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, visited the Western Wall this week as well, which is also extraordinary for an American politician. They've avoided doing that, I think, for quite a long time because they don't want to be seen as prejudging, perhaps, any final outcome on East Jerusalem.
Right? Yeah, it's a change in policy. But first, 2 years ago, President Trump visited the Western Wall, the last remnant of the ancient Jewish temple in East Jerusalem. President Trump went there, but without Israeli officials. That was kind of a compromise, that we're not necessarily recognizing Israeli control or sovereignty over those holy places in Jerusalem. But that's gone now, and I'm sure Secretary of State Pompeo knew what he was doing. He visited that Jewish site right below the famous Haram al-Sharif, the Islamic holy sites, with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Maybe we should add that there is some domestic implication for the president's decision here in the U.S. There is the upcoming AIPAC conference in Washington. There is the campaign going on. There is the evangelical vote that is very much supporting this kind of moves.
You're totally right. Sunday through Tuesday here in Washington, we have the AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby, 20,000 Americans who like Israel. And I agree with you. I think President Trump was clearly saying, I and Republicans totally support Israel, including Prime Minister Netanyahu, quietly indicating we want him to be reelected, whereas Democrats are divided. And you might recall about a week ago, President Trump explicitly said that Democrats have become an anti-Israel and anti-Jewish party.
Yeah, he said that Democrats hate the Jews.
So perhaps he's looking towards, say, Florida in 2020, which has a pretty significant population.
Almost
of
every
Jewish
story
folks
that we are discussing this week and in the weeks to come, now it should be with a view toward the November 2020
Absolutely.
Election. Trump is running and running hard.
Now, before we move on, Dan, this prospect of when the president came into office, maybe 2.25 years ago, he said, well, Middle East peace is easier than people think. We can do this. And then he kind of said, well, a two-state solution, a one-state solution, it makes no difference to me. I just want some kind of a deal. Where does all that stand?
Oh, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is in charge of the effort. And he and a former Trump real estate attorney, Jason Greenblatt, are putting together a peace plan for Israelis and Palestinians. It's said to include a wider economic picture for the Middle East in which everyone would get along beautifully. Okay, we don't know the contents. But in off-the-record briefings, Greenblatt and Kushner, again, the president's son-in-law, say it's coming after the Israeli election. We don't know what month, we don't know when, and we don't know what's in it. And after this recognition of the Golan, which upsets many Arabs and upsets Palestinians who think now Israel is going to annex the West Bank, the chances of success for a White House peace plan seem to have declined further.
There's Arab anger over Golan Heights. I mean, they were angry over the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem. They seem to have gotten over that.
I mean, I'm not so sure there really is a lot of hostility. Go to the Arab countries and speak with officials or certainly speak with people on the street, and they're aware of Trump being very, very pro-Israel, and Arabs don't like it. Israel likes it very, very much. Almost all parties in Israel do like it.
All right. Well, moving on, the president had a visitor from South America this week, the president of Brazil, Mr. Bolsonaro. Now, it's interesting, Felipe, he is called the Trump of the tropics because his views, his philosophy, his style, if you will, has said to pretty much mirror that of the president. So these guys got along quite well, apparently.
Absolutely. It was almost a textbook of how to become a good ally of the president of the United States. You have to think likewise. You have to align yourself ideologically and also politically and strategically. The Brazilian president went so far as to say that he agrees that most potential immigrants don't want to do good to the United States. We spoke of the Middle East. He's intending to transfer his embassy to Jerusalem following the U.S. move. I mean, those two guys get along very well. There is some sense of submission on the part of Bolsonaro towards Trump. And obviously, the American president loves that.
I thought it was very significant, White House officials pointing out that the two countries are the two largest economies in the Western Hemisphere, and they like to say the two largest democracies, and so it can be quite a partnership. Bolsonaro himself said that now Brazil has a president who is not anti-American. There were years of people who were considered socialists and certainly spoke against U.S. policies, and that's a big change, and so that's good for Trump. And most U.S. officials say, wow, Brazil is an ally. In fact, Trump suggested, as an ally, maybe Brazil should join NATO, the North Atlantic
Not
Treaty
exactly.
Organization.
He said he would grant Brazil the non-NATO major ally status.
He would start with that. About 16
start
countries
with that,
have that.
And then Brazil could get what Colombia got, which is being a NATO partner. Not exactly a NATO member, but close to it.
He also sees some sort of a help with the mess in Venezuela. as well. What's sort of the angle there, Dan?
Well, Brazil does have a long border with Venezuela, and Trump thanked the Brazilian president for permitting the pre-placement of a lot of humanitarian aid that the U.S. has sent. That immediately made skeptics think, is there some military secret here as well? Is there pre-placement of military supplies, perhaps for U.S. intervention in the future? And what did both presidents say? Nothing in public. President Trump simply said all options are on the table. And Bolsonaro, a former military man, said things that are discussed behind closed doors will not be debated in public. I got the feeling there's something going on that Brazil and the U.S. were cooking up.
It's interesting that for all of Bolsonaro's his views and his philosophy, he's just like Trump. He is head of the badly misnamed Social Liberal Party. Notice that? That's rather rather interesting. Well, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Philippe Chailly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House Correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Welcome back. The world's two biggest economies, the United States and China, remain deadlocked in a trade spat. President Trump says those talks are going well, but we've been hearing that for quite some time now, and there's still not been any kind of final breakthrough. The president also says that tariffs will remain in place on China, even though these talks are going quite well. That seems kind of contradictory, Philippe.
Not necessarily. This is the way the president of the United States negotiates and putting his counterpart under pressure. There will be talks in Beijing next week. The USTR, Bob Lighthizer, and the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, are flying to Beijing. There is ground for hope in the sense that there is already a draft, about 110, 120 pages. Still two big stumbling blocks, the biggest being the lack of confidence on the part of the U.S. about China implementing fairly, if you want, what they will agree upon. They want a monitoring system, and the Chinese are barking. They don't like that. There is a trust gap almost as big as the trade gap at this point.
And the trust gap, is that a two sides trust gap?
Well, a lot of U.S. officials are pointing out the clear reality, two very different economic systems. Decisions made in China by Chinese companies are, well, they certainly have to be approved by the Communist Party and the government of China. That's very different from the free enterprise system in the United States. And yet the two countries have to meet, and they have been meeting, but in a way that Trump and people close to him have said for years is so unfair. China's taking advantage, selling so much to the U.S., not buying much from the U.S., and they charge that the Chinese companies, again controlled by the government, they say, are copying a lot of intellectual property from Western goods. And so this is something that Trump says we can settle now once and for all. Philippe, I think the U.S. is backing away from some of these goals. They can't solve everything in these talks this year.
Probably not, but you have a U.S. president who loves tariffs. But on the other hand, you see the deficit in goods increasing to the advantage of China. So it doesn't really work, this policy of tariffs. And it cannot last so long, I think. We are, again, in an electoral campaign here in the U.S. It's already launched. The president needs some sort of great big bargain with China, a great signing ceremony at some point. And he's very eager to get that, at least as much as the Chinese.
Does the president understand that tariffs ultimately are paid by the end user, in other words, consumers, and not so much the actual exporter? So when he says that, well, these treasury coffers are filling up, does he understand, Dan, that in the end it's consumers who generally are paying for that?
Well, of course, I don't know what Donald Trump really understands, but as a politician, he says, he keeps repeating that the tariffs are great for the United States, that we're collecting that money from China. But tariffs, in fact, are a tax, and it's paid by the folks who buy those products or bring them in from overseas. And so eventually, it probably, if the tariffs continue or go up even higher, then it's American consumers who would have to pay more for our day-to-day items that are imported. And Trump's voters wouldn't like that. But, Philippe, I think the president assumes he's going to reach some deal, make it sound like a big win.
They are not that far apart at this point, so
and for
it's
all,
very possible.
Well, here's something else. There's also sort of all the focus here, this Trump-centric focus. What will the president do? What does the president think? But the Chinese media, which, of course, is state-controlled there, is full of an awful lot of stuff talking about the pressure that Xi Jinping is under not to buckle in to the Americans. You've got to be tough and not give in to Donald Trump. And that's something that I don't think is getting a lot of attention here.
It's all about there is this strategic competition between China and the United States with a lot of tension underneath. You even have this Thucydidean theory that when a dominating power is challenged by a new power, most of the times it can lead to war. The instances from Athens and Sparta up to the transfer of power from the British Empire to the United States, it's very, very rare that this goes peacefully.
Let's turn to Britain here, which is trying to figure out how to leave the European Union. It's been nearly 3 years now, I think, since British voters narrowly said that's what they wanted. Now, Dan, the EU has given Theresa May, the Prime Minister, of course, a little bit more time to make a deal with Parliament. But British lawmakers have already shot down on two occasions a deal to leave the EU. So it's hard to kind of keep track of all of this.
Even members of Prime Minister Theresa May's Conservative Party don't like what she has negotiated with the European Union. The EU is sick and tired of negotiating with her. But she did go to them and say, we cannot leave on March 29th because Parliament hasn't agreed how to leave, what the rules will be. Otherwise, we'd leave, we'd suddenly fall out of the EU with no arrangements. So the EU agreed and extended it at least till April 12th. But if Parliament passes something, then they'll have a date probably in May, more time to make the arrangements. Very embarrassing for Prime Minister May. Politically, you'd have to say she's on the way out. So in Britain, should we look toward perhaps a general election in which Jeremy Corbyn, the obviously very left-wing leader of the Labour Party, would have a chance of becoming prime minister? That seems likely to me this year.
And there's a lot of other moving parts here, too, Philippe. Britain could even leave the EU without any kind of deal. I think they call that the so-called hard Brexit. What would that look like?
Everybody is very scared about this possibility of a hard Brexit. There would be a major economic disruption. Some people in the UK even say that you would lack some products on the shelves.
They could run out of toilet paper because it's imported from European countries. Yeah.
Right. You will have to adjust to find new rules to import, export a lot of goods. So it could be very disruptive. The situation is already very complex because it's almost impossible to manage the House of Commons. I mean, you have people in favor of a soft Brexit. Some others want a hard Brexit. Some don't want a Brexit at all. And the postponement that was just decided by the EU is only technical. I mean, it's all related to the fact that on between May 23rd and 26th, you will have European elections in the 28 member states. So it has to be solved. There has to be some kind of decision on the part of the British government before the 22nd. If they agree to the plan, okay, they can get some time to make arrangements. But then, if not, they would have to participate to the European elections.
Which British people don't want to participate in the European Parliament elections when they're leaving the EU.
And
it's very confusing.
And it shows that the EU really does want to do the utmost to accommodate the British people. They would like to avoid a hard Brexit because it would be damaging for the rest of the EU as well.
Let's not forget the people-to-people factor. There are, if you add it up, millions of Europeans who are in the United Kingdom, Great Britain, and British people who are in European countries. And, of course, for decades, they've been able to just travel freely. And in the future, it looks like they will need visas. It's a huge change.
And there's a lot of economic fallout already. There are foreign companies, European companies that have British offices, for example, and they're scaling back. And the economic effect of that has sort of a ripple effect across, certainly in the greater London area.
Perhaps you'd agree. We knew it would be messy. Yep. We didn't know it would be this messy.
And that was before the mention of the toilet paper. I didn't even think about that. That's it. Well, these are big. These are sort of a big deals, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, finally, we do want to talk about the aftermath of these terrible attacks on the two mosques in New Zealand. The government of New Zealand and the people, in fact, there seems to be pretty broad support for taking swift action in the wake of these two attacks. What are they doing?
It seems stunning. 6 days after the massacre that killed 50 in Christchurch, the New Zealand government banned automatic assault weapons, the kind of guns used by the attacker at the two mosques. And the Prime Minister apparently felt that she had very good political cover for that because members of all parties agreed to do that. It's like the whole country was in shock. And of course, it made Americans wonder, how can any country do that in 6 days? Because America's been talking for years and years, especially after these mass killings at schools and public places, about maybe changing some regulations, and hardly anything gets done in the United States. Americans are stunned with what New Zealand has done.
Yeah, maybe they should ask otherwise the fact that it's only natural that after such a national catastrophe and drama, the politicians and the government should act. And here in the U.S., it's never the right time, you know. We shouldn't take a hasty decision like a few days after a massacre.
But that's because gun ownership seems to be part of United States culture.
Apparently it's also part of the New Zealand culture. I mean, they have 1 million weapons in circulation there.
A lot of hunting.
For
yes.
5 million population. Mm. And it doesn't stop them from arguing that no citizen needs to have an army weapon, you know, military magazines and semi-automatic weapons.
Paul, you're our constitutional expert. What's the big difference here?
Well, the difference here is that we have something called the Second Amendment, which says people have the right to bear arms. But of course, it's called an amendment because it can be changed. There's simply not the political will, at least in the Republican Party, the conservatives in the United States, to do that. The difference being in New Zealand, of course, even the conservatives there have swung hard in the direction of doing something. The head of the Conservative Party there said just within the last day or two, we agree that there is no need for the public to have access to these kind of military-style assault weapons. So clearly that's where they're going. And they're also going to spend a lot of money to buy back existing weapons too, I believe.
Yeah, and they will cover the cost of the funerals. They will cover the cost of the recovery of the wounded. I mean, it was really striking and remarkable to see the reaction, not only of the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, but the whole political class and the whole country really getting united, saying the proper words to comfort the victims there. You even have the Hells Angels and street gangs offering to protect the mosques.
And the model for what they're doing is based on Australia. They had a mass shooting, I think, in the mid-90s, 1996, I believe, in Port Arthur, which was just seared deeply into the minds of Australians. They took the kind of action that the New Zealanders are taking. And since that action in Australia, no mass shootings like this of any kind that I'm aware of, I think.
Obviously, isolated incidents can happen anywhere. There are still guns in any society. But Australia and now New Zealand are trying to put this on the record, as you said, Philippe, that individual citizens don't need to have these military-style weapons. And look what can happen when people who are extremists do have the weapons. In the United States, well, there's a significant number of politicians who feel very differently.
All right, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Philippe Gilly, he's with the Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv of Israel's I-24 News. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for joining us.